We now come to Prime Minister's questions, but we are joined today in the gallery by the Speaker of the Supreme Council of the Keir Giggs Republic. I now call Charlotte Nicholls.
Number one, please, Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Speaker, this morning I had meetings with ministerial colleagues and others. In addition to my duties in this House, including listening to the Chancellor's budget statement, I shall have further such meetings later today.
Charlotte Nicholls.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The UK used to be a world leader in psilocybin research, but despite the calls from the Home Affairs Select Committee, leading researchers, charities and veterans organisations and the Royal College of Psychiatrists, we've shamefully fallen behind on breakthrough treatment for conditions like PTSD and depression, causing misery to millions of people in our country. Can the Prime Minister explain why this policy remains the responsibility of a Home Office that can't give it the attention it deserves, and why it's okay that American, Canadian and Australian patients can access treatment British patients can't?
Mr. Speaker, I completely sympathise and understand why people suffering from distressing conditions will want to seek the best possible treatment available, and I thank the Honourable Lady for raising the issue. We are committed to ensuring that the UK is a world-leading jurisdiction for pharmaceutical, clinical and other medical research, and we have in fact asked the Advisory Council on the Misuse of Drugs to review barriers to legitimate medical research involving controlled drugs such as psilocybin. Our response to the Council's recommendations, I'm pleased to tell the Honourable Lady, will be published as soon as possible.
Dr. Kurumba.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My constituency has a long and proud history of farming, with generations of the same family helping to feed our nation. And not since World War II have we been so aware of how important food security is to our national security. So will the Prime Minister update the House on what his government is doing to support our fantastic farmers?
Mr. Speaker, as I set out at the NFU conference just a couple of weeks ago, we will always back British farmers to continue to produce fantastic food. We're accelerating that plan with the largest package of grants ever, and indeed one of those new schemes opens just today, supporting farmers with up to £125,000 towards the purchase of new equipment and technology. Our schemes in England are all about more choice, Mr. Speaker, not less, and unlike Labour in Wales, we will never introduce top-down arbitrary targets that damage farm incomes, damage our food security and take farmers back to square one.
We now come to the Leader of the Opposition, Keir Starmer.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. 3 years ago, Sarah Everard was walking home when she was abducted and murdered by a serving police officer who should have been trusted to keep her safe. As a father, I can't imagine the pain her parents, her family and her friends are going through in this difficult anniversary week. Lady Angelina's report exposes the appalling failure in police vetting and in misconduct processes, and I'm very troubled by its conclusion that there is, and I'm going to quote it, nothing to stop another cousin's operating in plain sight. How can that be the case 3 years on from this horrendous crime?
Mr. Speaker, can I firstly say that I'm sure all members of the House will have been thinking about Sarah Everard in recent weeks. It was, as the Honourable Gentleman said, an absolutely shocking case, and the abuse of power in particular was appalling. That's why we took action quickly, Mr. Speaker, to strengthen police vetting, strengthen the rules for rooting out officers who are not fit to serve, and conducted the largest ever screening of all serving officers and staff. We're now ensuring that any officer who has been charged for a crime will be suspended from duty automatically until their case is concluded, and we will thoroughly consider all of the report's recommendations and respond in full.
The Prime Minister mentions vetting, and I just want to press on that, because serious failures in police vetting were raised in independent reports as long ago as 2012, 2019, 2022 and 2023. And that's why Labour's been arguing for mandatory national vetting standards, which would stop anybody with a history of domestic abuse or sexual offending being allowed to join the police in the first place. Why are mandatory national vetting standards not already in place?
Well, Mr. Speaker, it is vital for public confidence that those that are not fit to wear the badge are rooted out of the police and not able to join in the first place. That's why the College of Policing has updated its existing statutory code on vetting, and that happened quickly. And in addition, the policing inspectorate, Mr. Speaker, carried out a rapid inspection of all forces' progress against the previous findings. And in addition to that, an entire check against the National Police database was carried out for all serving officers and staff.
Mr. Speaker, I'm obviously very familiar with codes in criminal justice systems, but this is too serious for that. There's a world of difference between a code and binding mandatory standards, which don't have legal effect. And that should trouble members across the House. Cousins' history of sexual offending stretched back many years. On four occasions, despite allegations of indecent exposure, he wasn't sacked. We know indecent exposure is a gateway to more horrific crimes, as was tragically shown to be the case, not only in Sarah Everard's case, but also Libby Squire. But it's not treated with the seriousness required. The Angelina report recommends reviewing all indecent exposure allegations against serving officers in order to identify, investigate and remove those officers from service. Now, given the obvious urgency of this recommendation, can the Prime Minister give a categorical assurance that it will be implemented immediately? Yeah.
Mr. Speaker, as the Home Secretary addressed this specifically when he made his statement, indecent exposure, just like any other kind of sexually motivated crime, is abhorrent, and we expect police chiefs to take it extremely seriously. We fully expect police chiefs to suspend an officer charged with any kind of sexually motivated crime. And it's worth pointing out, in addition to the new powers that the Home Secretary outlined about automatic suspension, chief constables already do have existing powers to suspend any officer in their force when allegations are made, and we fully expect them to use those powers.
It's all fine, is it? It's all okay.
Well, I do think the recommendation I referred to should be implemented urgently, and I ask the Prime Minister to look again at that, because every day that goes past when it isn't implemented carries risk for victims in these cases. Sarah Everard's murder should, of course, be a watershed moment on policing reform, on the criminal justice system, on violence against women and girls. But the sad reality is that victims of rape who have the courage and bravery to come forward have just a 2.4% chance of their perpetrators being caught and charged within the year. How does the Prime Minister expect women to have confidence in the criminal justice system when almost all rapists don't see the inside of a courtroom?
Well, Mr. Speaker, as we acknowledged a couple of years ago, of course we need to do more to improve rape outcomes in the criminal justice system. And the plan, the Rape Action Review Plan, is showing considerable progress, Mr. Speaker. We've already increased the average sentences for rape by a third since Labour were last in office, Mr. Speaker. By the way, using a power that the Labour Party voted against in this House. And thanks to our action plan, we've seen police referrals double, charges double, and last year there was a 50% increase in rape convictions, and now rapists will serve every single day of their sentence behind bars. And the Honourable Gentleman did raise his time at the Crown Prosecution Service, but he hasn't acknowledged that under his tenure, rape convictions actually dropped.
Well, the Prime Minister knows that is going to be fact-checked. He also knows I support tough sentences. I really do think that the victims of violence against women and girls deserve better than this nonsense from the Prime Minister. It needs to be taken seriously. It's not games, Prime Minister. We all want more victims to come forward, but we have to be honest. Unless things change, the criminal justice system will continue to fail them. That's why we're committed to introducing specialist rape and sexual offences teams in every force to give victims specialist support and confidence that their experience will be investigated properly. When will the Prime Minister commit to doing the same?
Mr. Speaker, we've already implemented a rape action review plan. He says we're taking this seriously. Here are the things that we have done, Mr. Speaker. We have ended the appalling digital strip search that victims had to go through with their mobile phones. We've ensured that there's better use of pre-recorded cross-examination. We've rolled out Operation Sorteria with incredible success across all national police forces, and we have increased significantly the number of independent sexual, domestic violence and abuse advisers to up to 1,000, and there is more specialist training in all police forces for these prosecutions. That is a plan that we've already put in place. It's a plan that is working to ensure that we can keep women and girls in our country safe.
Mr. Speaker, the problem is the rosy picture the Prime Minister tries to paint of the current criminal justice system is completely at odds with the confidence many women currently have in it. And with the publication of the Angelina report, the country deserves to know that we're doing all we can to make our country safe for women. That starts with what should be the most basic task, creating a safe workplace here in Westminster. And at the moment, as everyone in this House knows, we are failing in that endeavour, and we all have a duty to change this. So when will he make time for the vote on banning from Parliament MPs who face allegations of sex offences?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, it is absolutely right that we ensure our communities are safe for women and girls. That's why we passed the landmark Domestic Abuse Act. That's why we set up a new 24/7 victim support line. It's why we've quadrupled funding for victim support, and why we are investing in practical things like CCTV and better street lighting in safer communities up and down the country. Now, of course, there is always more we can do, but this government has a strong track record in ensuring that women across this country will feel safe.
Andrew Rosendale.
Mr. Speaker, sir, I want the Prime Minister to know that the people of Romford are struggling with ever-increasing energy prices, yet providers are making huge profits running into hundreds of millions. So, does the Prime Minister agree with me that reductions in wholesale prices should be passed on to the consumers and standing charges brought down? And will the government hold utility companies to account for their actions?
Well, Mr. Speaker, my honourable friend is right to highlight the challenge that high energy bills have posed, not just to his constituents in Romford, but across the country. That's why we stepped in with a significant package of support, paying for around half of a typical household energy bill when prices were at their highest. My honourable friend, I know, will join me in welcoming the fact that the energy price cap is set to fall by almost £250 in April, which will bring relief to many families. But we must hold companies to account, and that's why we introduced the energy profits levy on the windfall profits caused by an unexpected increase in energy prices. And we are going further to cut costs for people by cutting their taxes and putting more money in their family bank accounts.
SNP leader Stephen Flynn.
Mr. Speaker, much to my surprise this morning, it's been widely reported that the Conservative Party in Scotland are absolutely furious that Westminster is about to tax Scotland's natural resources in order to pay for a tax cut in England. Mr. Speaker, is the Prime Minister in danger of turning his colleagues into nationalists?
Mr. Speaker, obviously I wouldn't comment on the budget, but what I would say is, and when I was in Scotland last week, it was crystal clear there has only ever been one party consistently standing up for the North Sea energy industry, and it's the Scottish Conservatives.
The Prime Minister knows that not to be the case, but there's a serious point to be made here, Mr. Speaker. The Conservative Party want to use Scotland's natural resources to pay for tax cuts in England. The Labour Party want to use Scotland's natural resources to pay for nuclear power stations in England, and the cost of that up to 100,000 jobs. Scotland's wealth, Scotland's resources, Scotland's jobs, all a game to Westminster. But with the Tories on just 15% in the polls in Scotland now, will the Prime Minister do us all a favour and call a general election?
Mr. Speaker, the honourable gentleman claims to be supportive of the North Sea energy industry. Why is it that he's opposed all the measures that we have taken to protect those jobs in Scotland over the past couple of years? He talks about tax in Scotland and England. I'll just gently point out to him that, thanks to the actions of the Chancellor and this UK government, everyone in Scotland has received a significant tax cut from January this year. And in contrast to the Chancellor's last budget, the SNP's budget put taxes up for working Scots. Scotland is now the high-tax capital of the UK, but this Conservative government is going to keep cutting taxes for hard-working Scots.
The government is rightly acting to properly compensate the Horizon victims who are highlighted by Alan Bates's legal challenge. However, there are thousands more sub-postmasters across the country who are not actually prosecuted, but who faced financial penalties for bogus shortfalls, causing enormous financial and personal distress to them. Does the Prime Minister agree with me that we should now be doing everything possible to do right by all victims of gross miscarriage of justice, clear their names, and at last properly financially compensate?
My honourable friend is absolutely right to highlight the appalling impact this miscarriage of justice has had on people's mental health. As he acknowledged, our focus is on delivering justice for the postmasters, and that's why we will introduce legislation to overturn convictions and pave the way for the swift payment of compensation, which he acknowledged. But I thank my honourable friend for his long-standing campaign on this issue about mental health, and I can assure him that the Postal Minister is closely examining the issues he raises. He's considering next steps and will keep the right honourable gentleman closely informed.
Sir Geoffrey Donalds.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Prime Minister will be aware that the Government's proposals to deal with the legacy of our troubled past in Northern Ireland continue to be the subject of scrutiny, most recently in the High Court ruling in relation to compatibility with our human rights obligations. And yet, many families of victims in Northern Ireland are deeply disappointed with the lack of cooperation by the Irish government in relation to murders committed in their jurisdiction or from their jurisdiction. In relation to the Omagh bomb inquiry, for example, the Irish government has declined to conduct a public inquiry on this worst atrocity in our troubled past, despite the courts urging it to do so. Will the Prime Minister continue to press the Irish Government on the need for them to make available facilities to enable the families of innocent victims, including in Omagh, to pursue justice for their loved ones?
Can I thank my honourable friend for his question on this important topic, which I know will be of great interest not just to his constituents but many others across Northern Ireland. The Government has set forward its plans to deal with the legacy of the past and will continue to engage with everyone in Northern Ireland, whatever their views, to set out the best way forward. But I can confirm to him that the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland has raised these specific issues directly with the Irish government and will continue to do so. And I also spoke to the Taoiseach myself about this very matter. We would hope to see further cooperation on Omagh and many other outstanding cases that involve Irish jurisdiction, because like him, I want to give families as much information as possible.
Hello, Plessy.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Putin's put the Russian economy on a total war footing. He has increased military spending by 68% to 7.5% of GDP. He claimed this month that over 520,000 new jobs have been created in their arms industry, which now employs an estimated 3.5 million Russians. On my recent visits to Ukraine, I've met with government ministers and senior military figures who have expressed great frustration to me about the length of time it is taking to develop collaboration in building a defence manufacturing capability jointly with UK defence companies in Ukraine. So will my honourable friend meet with me to discuss how we can unblock the bureaucracy and, as our Ukrainian friends say, build the arsenal of the free world together?
Well, I can reassure my honourable friend that we remain steadfast in our support for Ukraine, and we will not allow Putin to achieve his aim of eradicating Ukrainian freedom and democracy. Our cross-government task force is working diligently to support both the armed forces of Ukraine and lead UK and Ukrainian defence industrial cooperation. I'm pleased to say in December last year we conducted our first successful trade mission to Ukraine alongside the UK defence industry, but I can tell him that the government and UK industry will continue to work hand in glove with our Ukrainian allies, seizing the opportunities for collaboration and bolstering our joint defence industries.
Stringer.
Mr. Speaker, last week the IPPR published a paper, The State of the North. That paper predicted that wealth inequalities, already too large between the North and the South East, would increase to nearly £250,000 per head by the end of this decade. Does the Prime Minister accept that his levelling up agenda has failed, or did he never want it to succeed?
Mr. Speaker, on the contrary, inequality in our country has actually declined under this Conservative government. And when it comes to levelling up in the North, it's actually the North that has received some of the highest amounts of per capita levelling up funding of any region in the country. And I know when he last popped up to ask me a question about our investment in the North, I was wondering if he's managed to get an answer as to what exactly the Labour Party's position on HS2 is, because I'd still like to know, because what we're doing is taking that money and reinvesting every penny of it across the North in forms of transportation that people use every day, delivering benefits quicker to communities, not just in his constituency, but across the entire North, and it's been warmly welcomed everywhere that I've been.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Would my right honourable friend agree that the performance of the Labour Party in voting down our Rwanda bill in the House of Lords is a disgrace? It is only the Conservative government and the Conservatives who have a plan for dealing with illegal immigration and the people's fund. Action on illegal immigration is a top priority in my constituency, and Labour has no policy or plan on this at all.
Mr. Speaker, my old friend makes an excellent point. He knows, like I know, that if you want to fully stop the boats, you need to have a working deterrent. That means if someone comes here illegally, you must be able to remove them to a safe third country alternative. That's why the Rwanda scheme is so important, and that's why we're determined to see it through. But it was just in the last week an independent report was published talking about the Labour Party's policies in this area, which made it crystal clear that they don't have a plan to stop the boats. And in fact, their idea would see the UK accept hundreds of thousands more migrants.
Mr. Speaker, which part of his economic legacy is the Prime Minister most proud of? Is it presiding over the highest tax burden since the Second World War? Or is it delivering the slowest real wage growth since the Napoleonic War?
Mr. Speaker, saving 10 million jobs in the pandemic with the furlough scheme.
The Prime Minister will know that there is consensus across this House on the need to build new houses. Where that consensus breaks down is where those houses should be built. Does the Prime Minister agree with me that wherever possible, new houses should be built on brownfield sites, not on green spaces, not on greenfield, and certainly not on prime farmland?
My honourable friend is absolutely right. It's sustainable planning that must be at the heart of our planning system. And that's why we're committed to meeting the needs of communities by building homes in the right places and, as he says, making best use of brownfield land. We've made it clear that that's what should be the priority. We've put extra funding aside to unlock those sites. And our recent changes to the MPPF provide clearer protection for the Greenbelt, making it clear how future housing supply should be assessed. And that is the clear difference between our two parties. On this side of the House, we will protect the Greenbelt and the Labour Party will concrete right all over it.
Thank you. Mr. Speaker, in some jurisdictions, ministers routinely publish their tax returns. The Prime Minister voluntarily published his UK tax returns last year. Does the Prime Minister agree that Ministers of the Crown should publish their tax returns as a matter of course? And has he ever filed any returns in the USA that have not been published?
Mr. Speaker, I don't think that would be proportionate or appropriate. And what I've done is. I don't think it would be proportionate for all ministers to publish their tax returns. In keeping with a long-standing tradition, I voluntarily published my tax return, as did the Chancellor. I think that is the right balance, and I've been completely transparent about that as I've done it.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Last year, a number of us were on the first transatlantic flight powered by sustainable aviation fuel. IAG made its first major purchase of that fuel. But that fuel is coming from the United States. And it's really important that we have a SAF industry in this country. So will the Prime Minister tell the Treasury and the Department of Transport to accelerate the work they're doing to put in place the right framework and the right support mechanism to ensure we have a SAF industry for our aviation sector for the future?
Can I first of all thank my honourable friend for his championing of this cause, which I think is absolutely right, and reassure him that we are committed to ensuring that the SAF mandate is in place in 2025. That will require about 10% of jet fuel to be made from sustainable feedstock by 2030. And to get there, we've provided, I'm pleased to tell him, £135 million to 13 different UK sustainable aviation fuel projects to kickstart our domestic industry. And, which he also knows is important, we've committed to introducing a revenue certainty mechanism to support SAF production in the UK as soon as practically possible.
Sam Dixon.
Thank you. Yeah. Chester's 2,000-year-old Roman walls are an important historic monument of world renown. Yep. Will the PM join me in Chester to walk the walls and explore how the government can support the upkeep of these important structures, which, unlike the Conservative Party, are stable, solid, and in no danger of imminent collapse?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I join the Honourable Lady in paying tribute to the history of her local community, and I'm pleased that the City of Chester is benefiting from so much investment from the Conservative government so that it can maintain its local infrastructure.
French.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. 5 weeks ago, Conservative MPs from across South East London and Kent wrote to Transport for London and the Labour Mayor of London, calling on them to do the right thing following the botched implementation of a temporary 40-mile-an-hour speed limit on the A20 near Sidcup, which has seen thousands of drivers unfairly issued fines and points on their licence. Yes. This has left many drivers, including carers, emergency service workers and teachers, at risk of losing their licences and jobs. This is despite travelling less than 50-mile-an-hour zones. Does the Prime Minister agree with me that TfL, the Met Police and Sadiq Khan must come clean about the number of fines and cancel these issued points?
Can I thank my honourable friend for this question? And I do understand the concerns that local drivers have over this ongoing TfL issue. Whilst we're doing everything we can to back motorists across the country, it is disappointing that the Labour Mayor and indeed Labour-run Wales are hammering drivers at every opportunity, whether that's temporary speed limits or blanket 20-mile-an-hour zones or the ULEZ expansion. But I will make sure that my honourable friend has a meeting with a responsible minister to discuss his concerns.
Who is coming?
Mr. Speaker, to strengthen current spiking legislation, forensic evidence is essential. The NHS does not have uniform policy for the screening of suspected victims of spiking at A&E. We can pass all the laws we want in this place, but to achieve justice, this forensic evidence is vital. Will the Prime Minister commit to ensuring that hospital emergency departments have a statutory obligation to take forensic samples from these victims?
I agree with the Honourable Lady that spiking is an appalling, violating crime which seriously undermines public safety, particularly the safety of women and girls, and we want to make sure that the existing laws recognise the threat that spiking poses, and that's why at the end of last year we announced a raft of new measures to confront spiking and support victims, including changing the law to make it clear without any doubt that spiking is illegal, as well as other measures like an online reporting tool, investing in research and rapid testing kits, and training for bar staff. But I'll ensure that we look into the issue that she raises and write back to her.
Final question, Ben Bradley.
This winter, flood and storm damage has caused significant damage to the infrastructure in and around my Mansfield constituency. That's our roads, it's our drains, it's flood infrastructure, and this is among the highest concern that residents raise with me on a regular basis. I'm really grateful that from next year in particular, there's very significant infrastructure funding coming our way. But what can my right honourable friend do to help fix this for my constituents now?
Well, Mr Speaker, I'm pleased that in 2020 we announced that we would double our flood investment to a record £5.2 billion. And in Nottinghamshire, since 2010, we've invested over £50 million to protect 15,000 properties. And I know currently there is a programme in Mansfield which is looking at surface water and drainage improvements. But I will make sure that I talk to the Chancellor that we have a strong economy to keep investing in local infrastructure in his area. And that's exactly what we're about to hear from my right honourable friend in just a second.
Complaints, Prime Minister's questions.